real name, he said. I will tell you my real name if you will take off your Batman costume. Charlie frowned. Actually, I have to keep my Batman costume on forever, he said. I smiled. Okay, Batman, maybe another time. Charlie started to build a sand wall between the wilderness and the suburbs of his city. He said. After a while, Lawrence came down the green steps and walked up to us.
I'll take over here, he said. Go up and see if you can talk some sense into Sarah, will you?
Why? What is wrong? Why didn't she come down here with you?
Lawrence held his hands out with the palms upward, and he sent air upward out of his mouth so that his hair blew.
Just go and see her, will you? He said.
I walked up the steps. Sarah was still standing by the railings. That bloody man, she said when she saw me.
Lawrence?
Sometimes I'm not so sure I wouldn't be better off without him.
Oh, I don't mean that, of course I don't. But honestly, don't I have the right to talk about Andrew?
You were arguing?
Sarah sighed.
Lawrence still isn't happy about you being around. It's putting him on edge.
What did you say about Andrew?
Sarah looked out across the river.
I told him I was sorting out Andrew's office last night. You know, looking through his files. I just wanted to see what bills I'm meant to pay now. Check we don't owe money on any of our cards, that sort of thing.
She looked at me. The thing is, it turns out Andrew didn't stop thinking about what happened on the beach. I thought he'd put it out of his mind, but he hadn't. He was researching it. There must have been 2 dozen folders in his office. Stuff about Nigeria, about the oil wars and the atrocities, and, well, I had no idea how many of you ended up in the UK after what happened to your villages. Andrew had a whole binder full of documents about asylum and detention.
Did you read it?
Sarah chewed her lip. Not all of it. He had enough in there to read for a month, and he had his own notes attached to each document. It was very meticulous, very Andrew. There was so much detail in there. I only read a couple of papers, but it was enough to see where he was going with it all. I read an inspector's report about the immigration detention centres.
How long did you say they kept you in that place, B?
2 years.
Oh, B, I had no idea how hellish they are. I was imagining, I don't know, a sort of high-security hotel, I suppose. Is it true they keep it deliberately cold in there? Is it true you have to apply in writing if you just need a paracetamol?
I sighed. If you are planning to have a headache, you need to apply 24 hours in advance.
Sarah sighed.
So it is true, then. Andrew highlighted this one passage that said, "We find the humiliating procedures excessive. We do not see how anyone could abuse an excess of sanitary towels." Did you really have to apply for them, too?
I nodded. They would only give them to us one at a time. You had to fill in a form.
Sarah twisted her hands together on the top bar of the iron railings. The thing is, she said, I think I know why Andrew highlighted that passage. I mean, people would skim-read the barred windows and the perimeter fence. But if you really wanted to bring it home, you'd show how a girl has to apply in writing for Kotex Ultra. Right?
She stopped, and she looked down to where Lawrence and Charlie were laughing and kicking sand at each other. When she spoke again, her voice was quiet.
I think Andrew was planning a book, she said. That's what I told Lawrence.
I looked up at Sarah.
That is why he was angry?
Sarah nodded. I said I thought maybe I should carry on Andrew's work. You know, read through his notes, find out a bit more about the detention centers. Maybe even, I don't know, write the book myself.
You said all that to Lawrence.
That's when he went ballistic, Sarah sighed. I think he's jealous of Andrew.
We stood and looked out over the river for a long time. A breeze had started to blow. It was not much, but enough to darken the smooth surface of the river.
Now, I thought. I gripped my hands onto the railings and tried to make the courage of the city flow into my bones again.
Sarah, I said, I want to tell you my feelings about Lawrence.
She looked at me sharply. I know what you're going to tell me. You'll tell me he cares more about himself than he cares about me. You'll tell me to watch out for him. And I'll tell you that's just what men are like, but you're too young to know it yet. And so you and I will argue too, and then I really will be utterly miserable. So don't say it, okay?
I shook my head.
Please, Sarah.
I don't want to hear it. I've chosen Lawrence. I'm 32, B. If I want to make a stable life for Charlie, I have to start sticking with my choices. I didn't stick with Andrew, and now I know I should have. But now there's Lawrence, and he isn't perfect, you're right, but I can't just keep walking away.
Sarah took a deep and shaking breath.
At some point you just have to turn around and face your life head on.
She looked at me for a long time, and then she held on to me, and we hugged each other tight.
Oh, B, said Sarah.
We stood and held each other like that, and after we had been quiet for a long time, Sarah stood up straight and swept back her hair.
Go down and play with Charlie and Lawrence, she said. I have to make a phone call.
I looked at Sarah and she smiled at me, and I walked back down the steps to the place Lawrence and Charlie were playing. They were picking up the small round stones from the edge of the mud and throwing them into the river. When I came close, Charlie carried on throwing stones, and Lawrence turned to me.
Did you talk her out of it? He said.
Out of what?
Her book. She had some idea she was going to finish a book Andrew was writing. Didn't she tell you?
Yes, she told me. I did not talk her out of the book, but I did not talk her out of you, either.
Lawrence grinned. Good girl, see? We're going to get along after all. Is she still upset? Why hasn't she come down here with you?
She is making a phone call.
Fair enough.
We stood there for a moment, looking at each other.
You still think I'm a bastard, don't you?
I shrugged.
I'm not, said Lawrence. I'll even help you, if you help me.
What help do you need from me?
You could just go, little bee, couldn't you? Quietly and without fuss.
I already thought about that.
So what's stopping you? Money? I can give you money.
I looked down at my shoes, and then I looked back up. You will pay me to go away?
Don't make it sound like that. It isn't easy to get started in this country without money for food and rent. I don't want to put you on the streets, that's all.
He was still holding a stone in his hand, and I took it from between his fingers. It was warm and smooth, and I turned it around and around in my hands, polishing it with the moisture in my palms. I said, "What is your wife's name?"
Lawrence looked at his hands. "Linda."
"And your children?"
Lawrence did not look in my eyes.
"Sonia," he said, "and Stephen, and Simon's the baby."
"Hmm."
I weighed the stone, and I turned it around and around between my fingers, and then I dropped it on the sand.
You should go back to them, I said. Lawrence looked at me then, and I felt a great sadness because there was nothing in his eyes. I looked away over the water. I looked and I saw the blue reflection of the sky. I stared for a long time now, because I understood that I was looking into the eyes of death again, and death was still not looking away, and neither could I. Then there was the barking of dogs. I jumped, and my eyes followed the sound, and I felt relief, because I saw the dogs were on the walkway above us, and they were only fat yellow family dogs, out for a walk with their master. Then I saw Sarah coming down the steps toward us. Her arms were hanging by her sides, and in one of her hands she held her mobile phone. She walked up to us, took a deep breath, and smiled. "I called work," she said. "I've got something to tell you both." She held out her hands to both of us, but then she hesitated. She looked all around the place where we were standing.
Where's Charlie?" she said.
She said it very quietly, then she said it again, louder, looking at us this time. I looked all along the thin strip of sand. Children were making their sand castles beside the river, although the level of the water was rising and the beach was getting narrower. None of the children was Charlie.
"Charlie!" Sarah shouted. "Charlie! Oh my God! Charlie!"
I spun around under the hot sun. We ran up and down. We called his name. We called again and again. Charlie was gone.
"Oh my God!" said Sarah. "Someone's taken him! Oh my God! Charlie!"
Horror filled me completely, so that I could not even move. While Sarah screamed for her child, I widened my eyes into the blackness of the drainage tunnels in the embankment wall, and I stared into them. I looked for a long time. I saw that the night horrors of all our worlds had found one another, so that there was no telling where the one ended and the other began, whether the jungle grew out of the jeep, or the jeep grew out of the jungle.
Chapter 10. I held little B for a long time. Then I asked her, "Will you go down and play with Charlie and Lawrence? I have to make a phone call." After she walked down the stone steps, I held on to the iron railing of the embankment, and I held on to my memories of Andrew, and I held on to my mobile phone. The phone was shaking in my hand, showing 5 bars of signal. The reception was so strong in the center of London, one hardly needed the handset at all. The air positively crackled with connectivity, as if one might simply direct a thought at someone and be received loud and clear. My tummy lurched, and I decided, "Right, I'll do it now, before I calm down and change my mind." I called the publisher and told him I didn't want to edit his magazine anymore. What the publisher said was, "Fine." I said, "I'm not sure you heard me. Something extraordinary has happened in my life, and I really need to run with it, so I need to quit the job." And he said, "Yeah, I heard you. That's fine. I'll get someone else." And he hung up. And I said, "Oh." I stood there for a minute, shocked, and then I just had to smile. The sun was lovely. I closed my eyes and let the breeze airbrush away the traces of the last few years. One phone call. I realized it was as simple as that. People wonder how they're ever going to change their lives, but really it is frighteningly easy. I was already thinking about how I might carry on with Andrew's book. The trick, of course, would be to keep it impersonal. I wondered if that had been a problem for Andrew. He never liked to put himself in the story.
But what if the story is that we are in the story?
I started to understand how Andrew must have agonized over it. I wondered if that was why he had kept so quiet.
Dear Andrew, I thought, how is it that I feel closer to you now than I did on the day we were married?
And after I just told little B I didn't want to hear what she had to say, because I know I need to stick with Lawrence.
This is the forked tongue of grief again. It whispers in one ear, return to what you once loved best, and in the other ear it whispers, move on.
My phone went, and my eyes snapped open. It was Clarissa.
Sarah, they just told me you resigned. Are you crazy?
I told you I was thinking about it.
Sarah, I spent a lot of time thinking about bedding premiership footballers.
Maybe you should try it.
Or maybe you should come into the office right now and tell the publishers you're very sorry and that you're going through a bereavement at the moment. And please, pretty please, could you have your nice job back?
But I don't want that job. I want to be a journalist again. I want to make a difference in the world.
Everyone wants to make a difference, Sarah, but there's a time and place. Do you know what you're doing, honestly, if you throw your toys out of the pram like this? You're just having a midlife crisis. You're no different from the middle-aged man who buys a red car and shags the babysitter.
I thought about it. The breeze seemed colder now. There were goosebumps on my arms.
Sarah?
Oh, Clarissa, you're right. I'm confused. Do you think I've just chucked my life away?
I just want you to think about it. Will you, Sarah?
All right.
And call me?
I will.
Clarissa?
Darling,
thank you.
I hung up and looked out over the river. When we first arrived, the water had been flowing downstream toward the wild estuary and the untamed waters of the North Sea. Now it was nudging back in the direction of Oxford and the crisp white boathouses of Henley. It is hard, when it comes right down to the actual choice, to know what you want out of life. I went down the stone steps to a little shrinking beach. I said to Lawrence and little B, I called work. I've got something to tell you both. But they looked so forlorn standing there, standing apart from each other, not speaking. I realized this was never going to work. I thought, oh gosh, how foolish I've been. I have always struck myself as a very practical woman, capable of adaptation. I immediately thought, I'll phone the publisher and tell him I made a mistake. And not just a little mistake, but a great elemental whole life mistake. During one whole week of grace, I utterly forgot, you see, that I was a sensible girl from Surrey. It was something about little B's smile and her energy that made me sort of fall in love with her. And thus love makes fools of us all. For a whole week I actually thought I was a better person, someone who could make a difference. It completely slipped my mind that I was a quiet, practical, bereaved woman who focused very hard on her job. Isn't that odd? I'm awfully sorry. And now, might I please have my old life back? I held out my hands to little B and Lawrence, but then I noticed that Charlie was no longer with them.
Where's Charlie?
It is painful to think about this time, even now.
What did I do? I looked all around, of course. I ran up and down. I began screaming Charlie's name. I raced up and down the shrinking beach, staring into the face of every child playing there, in case it should somehow transform into mine. I shouted myself hoarse. My son was nowhere. An aching panic took me over. The sophisticated parts of my mind shut down, the parts that might be capable of thought. I suppose the blood supply to them had been summarily turned off and diverted to the eyes, the legs, the lungs. I looked, I ran, I screamed. And all the time in my heart it was growing.
the unspeakable certainty that someone had taken Charlie. At the other end of the little beach was a second set of steps leading up the embankment wall, and I ran up them. Camped out on the top step was a picnicking family. The mother, long auburn hair with rather frazzled ends, sat cross-legged and barefoot, surrounded by the peelings and the uneaten segments of satsumas. She was reading BBC Music magazine. She had it spread out on the rug, pinned down with one foot to stop the pages blowing. There was a slender silver ring on her second toe. Beside her, on the step, two flame-haired girls in blue gingham dresses were eating Kraft cheese slices straight from the packet. The husband, blonde and stocky, stood a few feet away, leaning on the railing and talking into his mobile. "Lanzarote's just a tourist trap these days," he was saying. "You should go somewhere off the beaten track, like Croatia or Marrakesh. Your money goes further there in any case." I was out of breath. The mother looked up at me. "Is everything all right?" she said. "I've lost my son." She looked at me blankly. I smiled idiotically. I didn't know what to do with my face. My mind and my body were keyed up to fight with paedophiles and wolves. Confronted with these ordinary people in this absurdly pleasant tableau, ringed all around by strolling tourists, my distress seemed desperate and vulgar. My social conditioning fought against my panic. I felt ashamed. Instinctively, I also knew that I needed to speak to the woman calmly, in her register, if I was to communicate clearly and get across the information I needed without wasting any time. I have struggled all my life to find the correct point of balance between nicety and hysteria. "I'm very sorry," I said. "I've lost my son." The woman stood up and looked around at the crowd. I couldn't understand why her movements were so slow. It seemed that I was operating in air, while she occupied some more viscous medium. "He's about this high," I said. "You'd have noticed him. He's dressed as Batman. Did he come up these steps?" "I'm sorry," she said in slow motion. "I haven't seen anything." Each word took forever to form. I felt like waiting for the woman to engrave the sentence in stone. I was already halfway back down the steps before she finished speaking. Behind me I heard the husband saying, "You could always go for the cheapest package tour and just use the flights. Then you can find some nicer accommodation once you're out there." I ran back down the steps, shouting Charlie's name. Somehow I arrived back at the place where Charlie had built his sandcastles. I kicked the structures apart, shouting his name. While parents and children looked on aghast, I looked for my son under piles of sand as little as 6 inches high. Of course I knew Charlie wasn't underneath. I knew, even as I was scrabbling away at anything that protruded. I found an old crisp packet, the broken wheel of a pushchair. My nails bled into a barely submerged history of tides. Little Bee and Lawrence stared at me wide-eyed, and I remember the last rational thought that went through my mind. He isn't on the sand, and he didn't go up the steps, so he must be in the river. Even as I thought it, I could feel the second stage of my mind shutting down. The panic simply rose up out of my chest to engulf me. I splashed out into the Thames, knee-high, then waist-high, staring down into the muddy brown water, screaming Charlie's name at the floating plastic bags and the startled gulls. I saw something under the water, lying on the muddy sludge. Underwater, distorted by ripples, it looked like a bone-white face. I reached down and grabbed for it. I lifted it up into the bright day. It was a cracked plastic mask from a tourist stand, with its snapped elastic showing how it had blown into the river. As I held it up, dripping muddy water, I realized that my phone had been in the hand I held the mask in. My phone was gone, somewhere. My life was gone, lost in the sand or the river. I stood in the water, holding a mask. I didn't know what to do now. I heard a whistling sound, and I looked down sharply. I understood that the breeze was whistling through the empty eye-holes of the mask, and that is when I truly began to scream. Charlie O'Rourke, 4 years old, Batman. What went through my mind? His perfect little white teeth, his look of fierce concentration when he was dispatching baddies, the way he hugged me once when I was sad, the way, since Africa, that I had been running between worlds, between Andrew and Lawrence, between Little B and my job, running everywhere except to the world where I belonged. Why had I never run to Charlie? I screamed at myself. My son, my beautiful boy, gone, gone. He had disappeared as he had lived while I was looking the other way. I looked at the empty days before me, and there was no end to them. My voice sank to a whisper. I breathed Charlie's name. Then I felt hands on my shoulders. It was Lawrence.
"We need to be systematic about this now," he said. "Sarah, you stay here and keep calling for him, so he knows where to come back to if he's wandering. I'll go and ask people to start looking, and I'll keep looking myself. And B, you take my phone and you go up on the embankment and you call the police. Then you wait for them, so you can show them where we are when they arrive."
Lawrence handed his phone to Little B and turned back to me. I stared at him dumbly.
"I know it sounds extreme," he said, "but the police are good at this. I'm sure we'll find Charlie before they get here, but just on the off chance that we don't, it makes sense for us to bring them in sooner rather than later."
"Okay, do it," I said. "Do it now."
Little B was still standing there, holding Lawrence's phone in her hand, staring at Lawrence and me with large and frightened eyes. I couldn't understand why she wasn't already running.
"Go," I said.
She still stared at me.
"The police," she said.
Understanding buzzed dully in my mind. The number. Of course, she didn't know the emergency number.
"The number is 999, I said.
She just stood there. I couldn't work out what the problem was.
"The police, Sarah," she said.
I stared at her. Her eyes were pleading. She looked terrified, and then, very slowly, her face changed. It became firm, resolved. She took a deep breath, and she nodded at me. She turned slowly at first, and then very fast, and she ran up the steps to the embankment. When she was halfway up, Lawrence raised a hand to his mouth.
"Oh, shit, the police," he said.
"What?"
He shook his head.
"Never mind."
Lawrence ran off. I began shouting again for Charlie. I called and called while the tourists stared, and the breeze left me shivering in my wet jeans. At first I called out Charlie's name as a sound for him to home in on, but as my voice began to go, I realized that another line had been crossed, and I was shouting the name just to hear it, to ensure its continuing existence. I realized that the name was all I had in the world. Then a voice came from behind me. It was Lawrence.
"Sarah," he said, "it's okay. I found him."
Lawrence held Charlie in his arms. My son was filthy, and his bat cape hung straight down, heavy with water. I ran to him, took him into my arms, and held him. I pressed my face into his neck, and I breathed in his smell, the sharp salt of his sweat and the sewer tang of the dirt. The tears streamed down my face.
"Charlie," I whispered. "Oh, my world, my whole world."
"Get off, Mummy. You're squashing me."
"Where were you?"
Charlie held out his hands to the sides, palms upward, and answered me as if I was simple.
"In mine bat cave."
Lawrence grinned and pointed at the wall of the embankment.
"He was right inside one of those drainage pipes."
"Oh, Charlie, didn't you hear us all shouting? Didn't you see us all looking for you?
Charlie grinned beneath his bat mask.
I was hiding, he said.
Why? Why didn't you come out? Couldn't you see how worried we all were?
My son looked forlornly at the ground. Lawrence and B was all cross, and they wasn't playing with me, so I went into mine bat cave.
Oh, Charlie, Mummy's been so confused, so terribly silly and selfish. I promise you, Charlie, I'll never be so silly again. You're my whole world, you know that? I'll never forget that again. Do you know how much you mean to me?
Charlie blinked at me, sensing an opportunity.
Can I have an ice cream? He said.
I hugged my son. I felt his warm, sleepy breath on my neck, and through the thin grey fabric of his costume, I felt the gentle, insistent pressure of the bones beneath his skin. I looked up at Lawrence, and I said, "Thank you."
Chapter 11. The policemen came after 5 minutes. There were three of them. They came slowly in a silver car with bright blue and orange stripes along the sides and a long bar of lights on the roof. They pushed through the crowds on the walkway, and they stopped beside the steps that led down to the sand. They got out of the car, and they put on their hats. They were wearing white short-sleeved shirts and thick black vests with a black and white checkered stripe. The vests had many pockets, and in them there were batons and radios and handcuffs and other things I could not guess the names of. I was thinking, Charlie would like this. These policemen have more gadgets than Batman. If I was telling this story to the girls from back home, I would have to explain to them that the policemen of the United Kingdom did not carry guns.
Where? No pistol?
No pistol.
Where? That is one topsy-turvy kingdom, where the girls can show their bobbies but the police cannot show their guns.
And I would have to nod and tell them again, much of my life in that country was lived in such confusion. The policemen slammed the police car doors behind them. Thunk. I shivered. When you are a refugee, you learn to pay attention to doors. When they are open, when they are closed, the particular sound they make, the side of them that you are on. I wanted to run. Instead, I held my hands out to the policemen. I said, "Here is the place." One of the policemen came close, while the other two ran down the steps. The policeman who came, he was not much older than me, I think. He was tall, with orange hair under his hat. I tried to smile at him, but I couldn't. My heart was beating, beating. I was scared that my Queen's English would fail me. Then the most wonderful thing happened. The policeman's radio buzzed and crackled, and a voice came from it, and the voice said, "The child has been found." I gave a smile like the sun, but the policeman did not. My smile faded. If this policeman began to suspect me, he could call the immigration people. Then one of them would click a button on their computer and mark a checkbox on my file, and I would be deported. I would be dead, but no one would have fired any bullets. I realized this is why the police do not carry guns. In a civilized country, they kill you with a click. The killing is done far away, at the heart of the kingdom, in a building full of computers and coffee cups. I stared at the policeman. He did not have a cruel face. He did not have a kind face either. He was young and he was pale, and there were no lines on his face. He was nothing yet. He looked like an egg. This policeman, if he opened the door of the police car and made me get inside, then to him
It was only the inside of a car he was showing me. But I would see things he could not see in it. I would see the bright red dust on the seats. I would see the old dried cassava tops that had blown into the footwells. I would see the white skull on the dashboard and the jungle plants growing through the rusted cracks in the floor and bursting through the broken windscreen. For me, that car door would swing open and I would step out of England and straight back into the troubles of my country. This is what they mean when they say, "It is a small world these days." The policeman looked at me with no expression.
"What is your relationship to the person who was reported as missing?"
"It is not important."
"It's procedure, madam."
He took a step toward me, and I stepped back. I could not help myself.
"You seem unusually nervous of me, madam."
He said this very calmly, looking into my eyes all the time.
"Your name," he said, "now."
I stood up as straight and tall as I could, and I closed my eyes for a moment. And when I opened them again, I looked at the policeman very coldly, and I spoke with the voice of Queen Elizabeth II.
"How dare you?" I said.
It almost worked. The policeman took half a step back as if I had hit him. He looked down at the ground and he blushed, just for 1 second. But then I saw the strength come back into his face.
"That is when I ran."
"My story is not like the movie I told you about, the man who was in a great hurry. I did not have a motorbike to escape on, or a plane that I could fly upside down. In my mind, I saw how I would escape through the crowds, with the policeman chasing after me and shouting, 'Stop that girl!' I would run across the road, and the brakes of the cars would scream, and their horns would hoot, and a fat man would shout, 'What do you think you're doing?' And then I would be running, and of course there would be a seller of brightly colored fruits, and his apples and his oranges would spill all over the road, and there would be 2 men carrying a big sheet of glass, and I would roll under it, and the policeman would crash through it, and then I would get away and think to myself, 'Phew, that was a close one.' That is how the story went in my head, but in my life the chase was not so good. My legs started to run, and the policeman reached out his hand and grabbed hold of my arm, and that was it. If my life was a movie, it did not have a good chase scene. The audience would grumble and throw popcorn and say to one another, 'That foolish African girl did not even make it to the edge of the screen.'" The policeman opened the back door of the police car, and he made me sit down. He left the door open while he talked into his radio. He was thin, with pale, slim wrists and a little pot belly, like the detention officer who was on duty on the morning they released us. The police car smelled of nylon and cigarettes.
"If you could just start with your name."
I felt very sad. I knew it was all over for me now. I could not give the policeman my real name, because then they would find out what I was. But I did not have a false name to give him either. Jennifer Smith, Alison Jones, none of these names are real when you have no documents to go with them. Nothing is true unless there is a screen that says it is, somewhere in that building full of computers and coffee cups, right at the exact center of the United Kingdom. I sat up very straight in the back seat of the police car, and I took a breath, and I looked the policeman straight in the eye. "My name is Little B."
"Spell that for me, please."
Littlebee.
"And is that a first name or a surname, madam?"
"It is my whole name. That is who I am."
The policeman sighed, then he turned away and spoke into his radio.
Sierra 4 to control, he said. Send out a unit, will you? I've got one to bring in for fingerprints. Probably a natter.
He turned back to me, and he was not smiling any more.
Wait here, he said.
He closed the car door. I sat for a long time. Without the breeze, it was very hot in the back of the police car. I waited there until another set of policemen came and took me away. They put me into a van. I watched Sarah and Lawrence and Charlie disappearing in the back window through a metal grille. Lawrence had his arm around Sarah, and she was leaning against him. Sarah and Lawrence came to visit me that night. I was in a holding cell at the police station in Vauxhall. The police guard, he banged open the door without knocking, and Sarah walked in. Sarah was carrying Charlie. He was asleep in her arms, with his head resting on her shoulder. I was so happy to see Charlie safe, I cried. I kissed Charlie on the cheek. He twitched in his sleep and he sighed. Through the holes in his bat mask, I could see that he was smiling in his sleep. That made me smile too. Outside the cell, Lawrence was arguing with a police officer.
"This is a bit excessive, isn't it? They shouldn't deport her. She has a home to go to. She has a sponsor."
"They're not my rules, sir. The immigration people are a law unto themselves."
"But surely you can give us a bit of time to make a case. I work for the Home Office. I can get an appeal together."
"If you don't mind my saying so, sir, if I worked for the Home Office and I knew all along this lady was illegal, I'd keep my mouth shut."
And this, exactly, is what Lawrence did. I did not hear his voice after that. The guard looked into the cell.
"You've got 5 minutes, that's all," he said.
Sarah was crying. "I won't let them do it," she whispered. "I'll find a way. I won't let them send you back."
I tried very hard to smile. "Maybe you should not make a fuss. It would not be good for Lawrence, I think."
Sarah pressed her face down to the top of Charlie's head, and she breathed in his smell.
"Maybe Lawrence is going to have to look after himself," she whispered.
I shook my head. "Sarah," I said, "I do not deserve your help. You do not know everything about me."
"I think I know enough."
"Please listen, Sarah. I was there when Andrew killed himself."
"What?"
"Yes. And if I tried harder, I think I could have saved him."
There was a long silence between us. The only sound was Charlie breathing in and out in his sleep. The guard came into the cell.
"Time's up," he said. "Come on, please, madam. We need to lock up for the night."
On the concrete floor of the cell, I saw a tear splash, and I looked up into Sarah's face.
"You know what the worst thing is?" she said. "If I had tried harder, I suppose I could have saved Andrew too."
When she went, the cell door closed behind her with a noise like the boom of thunder on the first day of the rainy season. They came for me at 4 o'clock in the morning. There were 3 uniformed immigration officers, 1 woman and 2 men. I heard their shoes banging on the linoleum of the corridor. I had been awake all night, waiting for them. I was still wearing the summer dress that Sarah had given me, with the pretty lace around the neck. I stood up, so I was waiting for them when they banged open the door. We walked out of the cell. The door closed behind me. Boom, went the door. And that was it. Out in the street it was raining. They put me in the back of a van. The road was wet
and the headlights pushed streaks of light along it. One of the back windows was half open. The back of the van had a smell of vomit, but the air that blew in smelled of London. All along the streets, the windows of the apartments were silent and blind, with their curtains closed. I disappeared without anyone to see me go. The female officer handcuffed me to the back of the seat in front. "It is not necessary to handcuff me," I said. "How could I run away?" The female police officer looked back at me. She was surprised.
"You speak pretty good English," she said.
"Most of the people we bring in don't speak a word." I thought if I learned to speak like you people do, I would be able to stay. The officer smiled.
"It doesn't matter how you talk, does it?" she said. "You're a drain on resources. The point is, you don't belong here."
The van turned the corner at the end of the street. I looked through the metal grille on the back window of the van, and I watched two long rows of semi-detached houses disappear. I thought about Charlie, fast asleep under his duvet, and I thought of his brave smile, and my heart ached that I would never see him again. There were tears in my eyes.
"But please, what does it mean?" I said. "What does it mean to belong here?"
The female officer turned to look at me again.
"Well, you've got to be British, haven't you? You've got to share our values."
I turned away from the woman and looked out at the rain. 3 days later, a different group of officers took me from another holding cell and they put me in a minibus with one other girl. They took us to Heathrow Airport. They took us straight through the queue at the airport terminal, and they put us in a small room. We were all wearing handcuffs. They told us to sit down on the floor. There were no chairs there. There were 20 others in the room, men and women, and it was very hot in there. There was no fresh air, and it was difficult to breathe. A guard was standing at the front of the room. She had a truncheon and a can of pepper spray in her belt. I asked her, "What is happening here?" The guard smiled. She said, "What is happening here is that a large number of flying machines that we call aeroplanes are taking off and landing on a long stretch of tarmac that we call a runway, because this is a place that we call an airport. And soon, one of those aeroplanes is going to set off for Umbongo Land where you come from and you're going to be on it, yeah? Whether you like it or bloody not. Now, has anyone else got any questions?" We waited for a long time. Some of the others were taken out of the room. One of them cried. Another, a thin man, he was angry. He tried to resist the guard, and she hit him twice in the stomach with her truncheon. After that, he was quiet. I fell asleep sitting down. When I woke up, I saw a purple dress and long brown legs in front of me. "Yvette," I said. The woman turned around to look at me, but it was not Yvette. At first I was sad not to see my friend, and then I understood that I was happy. If this was not Yvette, then there was a chance that Yvette was still free. I thought of her walking down the street in London, in her purple flip-flops, with her eyebrows painted in pencil, buying a pound of salt fish and laughing, "Whoa, ha, ha, ha," into the bright blue sky, and I smiled. The woman who was not Yvette, she made an angry face at me. "What is wrong with you?" she said. "You think they are sending us on holiday?" I smiled. "Yes," I said. "I think it will be the holiday of a lifetime."
"You should not joke about these things."
She turned around, and she would not talk to me any more.
and when they called her to stand up for her flight, she walked away without making any trouble, and she did not once look back at me. When I saw her go, my situation became real for me, and I was scared now, for the first time. I was scared of going back. I cried, and I watched my own tears soaking away into the dirty brown carpet. They gave us no food or water, and I became faint. After a few more hours, they came for me. They walked me straight onto the aeroplane. The other passengers, the paying passengers, they made them stand back while I went first up the aeroplane steps. Everybody was staring at me. They took me to the back of the aeroplane, to the last row of seats before the toilets. They put me in the seat next to the window, and a guard sat down beside me, a big man with a shaved head and a gold earring. He wore a blue Nike t-shirt and black Adidas trousers. He took off my handcuffs, and I rubbed my wrists to bring the blood back into my hands.
"Sorry," said the man. "I don't like this shit any more than you do."
"Then why do you do it?" The man shrugged and did up his seatbelt.
"It's a job, isn't it?" he said.
He pulled a magazine out of the seat pocket in front of him and opened it up. There were men's wristwatches there for sale, and also a fluffy model of the aeroplane that could be given to children. "You should do a different job if you do not like this one."
"No one chooses this job, love. I don't have qualifications, do I? I used to do labouring casual, but you can't compete with the Polskis now. The Poles will do a full day's work for a kind word and a packet of fags. So, here I am, chaperoning girls like you on the holiday of a lifetime. Waste, really, isn't it? I bet you're more employable than I am. You should be escorting me, really, shouldn't you? Back to this place we're going, whatever the name of it is again."
"Nigeria."
"Yeah, that was it. Hot there, is it?"
"Hotter than England."
"Thought so. These places usually are, where you people come from."
He went back to his magazine and he turned a few pages. Each time he turned the page, he licked his finger to make it stick. There were tattoos on the knuckles of his fingers, small blue dots. His watch was big and gold, but the gold was wearing off. It looked like one of the watches from the aeroplane magazine. He turned a few more pages, and then he looked up at me again.
"Don't say much, do you?"
I shrugged.
"That's all right," he said. "I don't mind. Rather that than the waterworks."
"The waterworks?"
"Some of them cry. Some of the people I escort back. The women aren't the worst, believe it or not. I had this bloke once. Zimbabwe we were going to. Sobbed away for 6 hours straight. Tears and snot everywhere, like a baby. I kid you not. It got embarrassing after a while. Some of the other passengers, you know, giving it the looks and all of that. I was like, 'Cheer up, mate. It might never happen.' But it wasn't no good. He just kept crying and talking to himself in foreign. Some of you people, I'm sorry to see you go. But this one, I tell you, I couldn't wait to sign him over. Good money, though, that job was. There was no light out for 3 days, so they put me up at the Sheraton. Watched Sky Sports for 3 days, scratched my arse, got paid time and a half. Course the people who really make the money are the big contractors. The ones I'm working for now, Dutch firm, they run the whole show. They run the detention centres, and they run the repatriations. So they're earning either way, whether we lock you up or whether we send you back. Nice, eh?"
"Nice," I said. The man tapped his finger against the side of his head.
But that's how you've got to think these days, isn't it? It's the global economy.
The plane began to roll backward on the tarmac, and some television screens came down from the ceiling. They started to show us a safety film. They said what we should do if the cabin filled with smoke, and they also said where our life jackets were kept in case we landed on water. I saw that they did not show us the position to adopt in case we were deported to a country where it was likely that we would be killed because of events we had witnessed. They said there was more information on the safety card in the seat pocket in front of us. There was a huge and terrifying roar, so loud that I thought they have tricked us. I thought we were going on a journey, but actually we are being destroyed. But then there was a great acceleration, and everything started shaking and rising up to a terrifying angle, and suddenly all the vibration was gone, and the sound died down, and my stomach went crazy. The man beside me, my guard, he looked at me and laughed.
"Relax, love. We're in the air."
After the takeoff, the captain came on the intercom. He said it was a fine sunny day in Abuja. I understood that for a few hours I was not in anyone's country. I said to myself, "Look here, little bee, finally you are flying. Buzz, buzz." I pressed my nose against the aeroplane window. I watched the forests and the fields and the roads with their tiny cars, all those tiny, precious lives. Me, I felt that my own life was already over. From very high up in the sky, all alone, I could see the curve of the world. And then I heard a voice, a kind and gentle voice that was familiar. "Bee?" said the voice. I turned from the window and saw Sarah. She was standing in the aisle and she was smiling. Charlie was holding her hand and he was smiling too. He was wearing his Batman outfit and he was grinning as if he had just killed all the baddies.
"We is in the sky, isn't we?" he said.
"No, darling," said Sarah. "We are in the sky, aren't we?"
I did not understand what I was seeing. Sarah reached over the guard and she put her hand on my hand.
"Lawrence found out what flight they were putting you on," she said. "He's not entirely bad at the end of the day. We couldn't let you go back alone, Bee, could we, Batman?"
Charlie shook his head. Now he looked very solemn.
"No," he said, "because you is our friend."
The guard, he did not know what to do.
"I've seen bloody everything now," he said.
Finally, he stood up and made room for Sarah and Charlie to sit beside me. They hugged me while I cried, and the other passengers turned around in their seats to stare at this miracle. And the aeroplane flew all of us into the future at 550 miles per hour. After some time they brought us peanuts and Coca-Cola in tiny cans. Charlie drank his too quickly, and the Coca-Cola came out of his nose. After Sarah cleaned him up, she turned to me. "I did wonder why Andrew didn't leave a note," she said. "And then I thought about it. It wasn't Andrew's style. He didn't really like to write about himself." I nodded. "Anyway, he left me something better than a note."
"What?"
Sarah smiled. "A story." At Abuja, they opened the aeroplane doors and heat and memory rolled in. We walked across the tarmac through the shimmering air. In the terminal building, my guard signed me over to the authorities.
"Cheerio," he said. "Best of luck, love."
The military police were waiting for me in a small room, wearing uniforms and gold-framed sunglasses. They could not arrest me because Sarah was with